Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to the NIDS View. Of course, I'm Adam Lowther, along with Curtis McGiffin and Jim Petrosky, and we have another great show for you. Today, we're going to talk about, well, there was an article in World Politics Review that sort of stirred the pot a little bit. It came out a few days ago. What We Don't Know About Nuclear Deterrence Could Hurt Us, by Paul Post. Again, it was at World Politics Review, so you can go check it out yourselves. And the article called into question deterrence writ large, and it made some valid points. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I thought, you know, he made some valid points that essentially deterrence works when nothing happens. And because that is the nature of deterrence, it's often hard to know whether, you know, deterrence works. And so that was sort of the fundamental challenge. And he offered a few points in terms of what some alternatives might be. There was a great book that came out a few years ago, The Better Angels of Our Nature, that essentially said the whole reason that war is declining is not because, you know, nuclear deterrence works, but because human nature is changing and we're becoming more pacific. And he offered a whole bunch of data to try to make that case. And so the idea here is just that there might be other things that explain why deterrence works as opposed to nuclear weapons. So with that, I wanted to turn it over to you first, Jim.
Adam, I just wanted to let you know, I love proving a negative. And so, you know, I listen to this podcast every week and I haven't died. So listening to this podcast caused me not to die, because I proved that by not dying and listening to this podcast. So there you go. I've already shot my first salvo out.
So does that mean this podcast brings life?
Oh, it does. It just prevents death. Okay. So yeah, I proved it.
Well, there's, you know, in political science, when you're a student, there's a very famous analogy that you learn in your research methods class. And it's about, you know, there's a lot of frogs the same time as the French grape crop is really good. So therefore, more frogs must mean, you know, better grapes. But in reality, it's, you know, there's more rain, which means more frogs, which means, a better grape crop. So correlation versus causation. So if we delve into his argument, and part of his argument was just, this was the recent Emmanuel Macron idea of, hey, let we the French offer Europe a nuclear deterrent, an extended deterrent, that we'll make it a Euro nuke. I think we've talked about this before. But then he says, well, hold on here a second. There's a lot we don't know about whether deterrence actually works, particularly nuclear. So, Curtis, this was something that you got a little bit animated about, and I figured you'd have some words. So with that, let me see what you have to say.
I always got words. I don't know about being animated, but I always got words. So it's just this article was an interesting one. It's just sort of recycled idea that, you know, I don't like nuclear weapons, and nuclear deterrence puts nuclear weapons in a positive light. So therefore, I got to talk down nuclear deterrence. And we see this often. We hear this often. We read this too often. And so nonetheless, you know, here we are. We'll debate it again. And I think that's, you know, part of the fun. You know, we got to keep things fresh in that sense. I would say here that it is always difficult to prove a negative, right? That is, and Jim just tried it. He gave us a scientist's example of it. But it is a difficult metric to keep. The things that didn't happen, right? How do I score that, right? Think about commercial flight, Adam. You know, airplanes take off and land tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands a day or a week, depending upon how you want to do it. And flight is generally regarded as a safer than driving your car. But, you know, you get one airplane crash and all of a sudden everybody's upset. Well, maybe the ones who are engaged or involved or somehow a victim of that crash. But it really doesn't seem to keep people from going back into the airlines and traveling off to wherever vacation spot they want to go to. So the fact that there is a crash every now and then of a commercial airliner doesn't seem to deter or dissuade the average passenger from getting back on an airplane, and it doesn't really change the statistic. Well, nuclear deterrence is kind of the same thing. It goes on every day, and it just sort of happens in the background, if you will. We sort of assume it's always going to work, right? You get on that airplane, you assume it's going to take off just fine, and it's going to land just fine. And there is always a chance, just as there's always a chance that airplane might not land, is a chance that deterrence could fail. So then the question is why did that airplane not land? Why did deterrence fail? So you go back and investigate after the fact and you figure out what happens, right? So we think, well, an airplane didn't land properly because maybe there was a maintenance issue, or maybe it was weather or something like that, or the always blamed pilot error, right? But there's always, almost always, an investigation that finds the answer that we can all sort of hang our hats on and say, okay, that's why this airplane went down. Well, when we look at deterrence, it's, you know, you look back and go, well, where did we screw up in the messaging? Where did we screw up in the resourcing? Did we posture our forces incorrectly? And sort of think, how did we influence or shape the thinking of the adversary? Did we do too much or too little? And often that is also something that you cannot determine until after the damage is done. And when you think about the invasion of Ukraine by Putin in 2022, after the horrific messaging that went on from the West, and specifically, you know, the administration, about what Putin should and shouldn't do, and then he wasn't deterred and he invaded Ukraine, we all want to say, well, deterrence failed. Well, at least Mr. Professor Post might want to say that. The reality is it failed for that moment, but it hasn't failed beyond that level. And so these are some of the challenges, is understanding the butterfly effect that is deterrence. And I want to expand more on that in the podcast here, but I want to just sort of introduce this idea that deterrence is very much a part of the massive butterfly effect.
Yeah, Curtis, I appreciate that start, and I'll probably add on to that. But I want to unpack a little bit of some stuff that we said in some previous The Nids View podcasts. And my first is, when you talk about deterrence and you talk about Cold War, and you say, well, in the past, you know, mutually assured destruction, it was really worrisome. Well, I would say that if you go back and you look at the Cold War, how many nuclear wars did we have during the Cold War? I would add those all up to be a sum total of zero. And so I would say we were quite effective in having a nuclear deterrent. And even with the mutually assured destruction angle put there, did it worry, as this article says, did it worry some people? It worried people, but let's talk about worry. Did it worry us that we had mutually assured destruction, or more so, did it worry us that we had to go to such extremes to use, you know, to use nuclear weapons in an aggressive way against Japan to stop them from doing what they were doing to the United States and to the world writ large, in order to stop the advancement of Japan in the Pacific region? We had to go to an extreme in order to do that. That worries me that we had to do that. And that wasn't because they had nuclear weapons. That had to do with the fact that their ambitions were to completely subjugate the entire world to a Japan-centric view at the time, the imperialistic Japanese view. So, yeah, that worries me that we have to go to that extreme. but it doesn't stop me from doing what I'm worried about. The worry was, you know, to stop this imperialistic advancement on the entire world. So yes, I'm glad we had the weapons, and I'm glad we were able to use them in a way that stopped what could have been much more disastrous. So sometimes we don't remember to compare those worries, if you will. I'm not worried. I think it's a concern that we have to go to that level. And I would say the same thing with what's going on in Ukraine. We are worried that Russia is at least using their nuclear weapons to try to gain advantage in a region, in a situation where they felt that the nuclear weapon umbrella that we had was not going to be used. To be honest, that worries me, that we weren't clear in our communications. I'll use, you know, Curtis's vitamin C argument that he makes for deterrence. One of those being communications, we didn't communicate it well. So, so I have some more to unpack there, but I'm going to start with that because I think it fits into your butterfly effect concept, Curtis, in that what happens when one thing happens is not necessarily received in the same way on the other side. Mm-hmm. So we'll go from there.
So in the article, he says, and I'm quoting, "Overall, assessing the deterrence credibility of nuclear weapons or deterrence in general is extremely difficult. This is because we never observe deterrence." Now, what I would argue is that that's not really accurate. It may not be as readily apparent as some other activities. I mean, this is in part why, you know, Albert Einstein said, you know, I can get the physics right, but it's the policy and the strategy that's really hard. And with deterrence, you can measure it. Let me give you an example. So if you go back and you look at the historical record of the Vietnam conflict, and you read the, you know, historians are now reading the internal debates within, you know, within the Nixon administration, within, you know, what was going on in the Soviet Union and in China. And so when you read those internal debates, you hear the president, for example, and his advisors saying, "Hey, we don't want to do this. You know, we don't want to invade north of, you know, the South Korean border because we're afraid that the Chinese or the Russians will get involved." So you can, in your historical analysis, often read, you know, whether it's the writings of Mikhail Gorbachev or the historical record of Khrushchev or U.S. presidents, and they write, they give speeches, there's internal memos that discuss why a nation and its leaders do and don't do things. And when you do that and you build these case studies, those case studies can offer you a very clear image. I think Korea, Vietnam are two great examples where nuclear weapons and the fear that two superpowers armed with nuclear weapons would collide, therefore they set limits on conflict, that gives you very good, very clear examples of when nuclear, specifically nuclear deterrence, works. And yeah, so the idea you can't measure it is just not true.
Yeah, Adam, yeah. I'll invoke the great Albert Einstein also in saying that, you know, when you say something cannot happen, you know, whether it's settled science or whatever that he was discussing at that time, he says all you need to prove it differently is one example of it being wrong, and it's no longer the fact. So if we're going to use that as the example, I have yet to see the one place where nuclear deterrence has not stopped nuclear deterrent or other nuclear weapons being used, mm-hmm. because it hasn't been used since since World War II, or if you want to say they've been used once, well, sure, we've used them once that way. I know we use them every day. That's the other argument.
But, so again, you mean employed.
Yeah, employed. Yeah, thank you, Curtis. Yeah, employed. But I will say that I can give you oodles of examples where diplomacy has failed and we've had conflict. So maybe we should get rid of diplomacy. And conventional weapons, You know, they've failed too to deter. So let's get rid of conventional weapons. How about treaties? Has treaties ever stopped us from ever having conflict? Oh, no. So we shouldn't do treaties either. I'd say the only one that I can give you an example of that we don't have that one example are nuclear weapons.
Well, you know, let me say this. I think there is another metric that we can use, and that is the number of countries that want to garner nuclear weapons and don't want to give up the ones that they have, right? So, you know, we know that, for example, that there were threats of the atomic bomb by Eisenhower arguably brought the Korean War to some sort of end. We know that fear of encroaching upon a nuclear-armed China contained American behavior in the Vietnam War to some extent. And we know that that nuclear weapons have been the go-to threatening device by Putin in his wars with Ukraine, and they have worked to some extent. And we know that there are countries that have become nuclear powers, right? We know North Korea, Pakistan, India, all have become nuclear powers, you know, beyond the World War II powers. That arrived victoriously out of the post 1945 have become nuclear powers, or countries that are thinking about it and have thought about it in the past. You know, many countries have had nascent nuclear programs at one point or another, and South Africa really being the only country to surrender their nuclear weapons in 1994, really more so a part of the post-apartheid era, but also because of the elimination of the threat to the country, right? The weapons existed in South Africa because there were 80,000 Cubans in Angola, and South Africa didn't have the conventional army to fight that. So they needed that nuclear capability to do that. So I would argue that there are the facts bear it out. There are more nuclear powers today than there were 50 years ago, and they're acquiring nuclear weapons for a purpose, for a reason, because it brings them security and allows them to enforce their national interests, if you will. And so if you're looking for a metric on the valuation of nuclear deterrence, you only need to count the aspirant nations.
Yeah, I'd also say, Curtis, I just want to correct you. If I'm not mistaken, didn't Ukraine give up its nuclear weapons?
I stand corrected.
Oh, sorry.
And so did Libya, its nascent program at Libya. And that didn't work out so well for poor Gaddafi either, did it?
Well, I mean, Ukraine didn't actually give up their weapons. They returned Russian weapons that were unusable by the Ukrainians. They didn't have the codes. They could have never used them. So
let me add to that, Adam, because your point here is interesting. You know, Dr. Post here argues about the Budapest Memorandum here in his article, and he clearly hasn't read his colleague Professor Mearsheimer's article on 1993 article on why Ukraine should keep its nuclear weapons, where he lays out specifically the possibility that Russia may change its mind and decide to invade. But nonetheless, and I say colleague because they both teach at the University of Chicago, I would say that he puts in here, he writes in this article that because of the Budapest Memorandum, that NATO countries, and I quote, had an obligation to protect its territorial integrity. It knoweth nowhere in the Budapest Memorandum does it imply or declare that the United States or any other country has an obligation to protect its territorial integrity in the sense of defense. The declaration was we would respect their territorial integrity. And there's only one violator of that, and that's Russia. And so we need to make sure that we understand who is and what is with regard to the Budapest Memorandum, and how that is to be laid out. And this is an example to the world why non-treaty agreements are bad news if you're looking for security as a state.
So there's two points that he does make that, you know, are worth discussing, and there's some validity to both. And that is, you know, he discusses, hey, the Iranians are attacking a country that is believed to have nuclear weapons in Israel. And so therefore, clearly, you know, an attack, you can attack a nuclear armed state, just like Al-Qaeda attacked the United States in September 2001. And then, so what are the, when does deterrence hold, nuclear deterrence hold, and when does it not? That's a valid point of discussion. And then the second thing he says that it's absolutely true is that because we have so few instances of nuclear weapons being employed since 1945, we therefore don't have, you know, we don't have a large N for us to study and understand the, you know, when deterrence succeeds and when it fails. Whereas if you take, you know, for political scientists who study war, there's this big data set called the correlates of war, and there's thousands and thousands of data points that you can use, and you can run all sorts of regressions and other statistical methods to get at the data to try to understand some point. And so those are sort of two things that he does offer that have some utility, you know.
Adam, I'll agree. I do like, and I was going to highlight this at the end, but I'll highlight it now in coordination with it. It says, you know, determining whether deterrence is credible with nuclear weapons is extremely difficult. It is. And that's why studying, discussing, looking at historical examples, keeping people informed as to how things work in an international community are extremely important, and it needs to be studied. And I think that is a value of this overall. However, comma, I would say the fact that we don't have a lot of examples sort of speaks to the truth on how nuclear weapons and that paradox of having them keeps them from being employed is sort of highlighted in that statistic. Not provable, because you can't prove a negative. I can't tell you what you were going to do or what would have happened tomorrow when tomorrow hasn't happened yet. I get that. But overall, that's, you know, I can tell you bullets haven't stopped bullets because bullets are being fired every day. I do like your assessment, and I think Curtis got to this also, into understanding at what level does the nuclear deterrent stop aggression in some fashion. Now, I think we're seeing with what Putin's doing, which is sort of interesting, is he's using this threat of nuclear weapons rather daily to stop bullets, not nuclear weapons, from being used and stop activities. And this is an interesting part of the study, which I think there is a lot of historic example of that threat of nuclear weapon employment that helps to give some credibility to our nuclear force.
Well, let me add to this as well, to Jim's point. With regard to the Iranian attack on Israel, this is actually a great example, and maybe contradicts a little bit of Professor Post's article here, where he says, you know, we know leaders have considered using nuclear weapons as an option during crises. My guess is that, there are thresholds, right? So there are always thresholds that are in there. Israel is not a... You know, I want to inform our audience, Israel is not a declared nuclear power. It is neither confirmed nor denied, and the U.S. government has neither confirmed nor denied. It is an issue of ambiguity that everyone seems to embrace. So you could argue that the Iranians didn't know they were attacking a nuclear power. Now, I understand that our listeners may be thinking, Curtis, what are you saying? Are you crazy? But the point here is that officially, they are not a declared nuclear power. And so to argue that they can then deter with something that they don't claim to even have is a ridiculous posit. But I would say this, that, you know, there have been several examples here. The Argentines attacking the Falkland Islands. The British were, of course, a nuclear power, and the Argentines weren't in the 1980s. And then maybe this is another fine example. Arguably, Yom Kippur, 1974, and some of these other opportunities, you know, with where you might have suspected, but again, not confirmed. So why would the Argentines attack a nuclear power? Because they probably didn't believe that there was any resolve on the part of the Brits to actually employ nukes. And the reality was the Brits didn't need to, right? This was a sort of a small effort. When we look at whether or not Iranians are using, you know, thinking about Israeli potential for nukes, they probably don't deem them to be credible. I mean, if they could even assume that they have them. So you cannot deter with something you don't declare to have. It's certainly not very well. And even then, you're going to set thresholds. And if you're deliberately ambiguous in your thresholds about when you might use nuclear weapons, then your deterrence levels go up, right? And so then you say, well, you didn't stop this conflict. Well, that's because I wasn't trying to, you know, my threshold was too high. And if you set your threshold too high, you're going to get a lot of war below that threshold. And so what Putin is trying to do is lower that threshold by threatening the employment threshold to bring it down, right, by using smaller – by the threat of using smaller weapons. Now, I want to point out to the audience, as of May 15th, he has not employed a nuclear weapon after 2+ years and a lot of threats. So clearly, whatever the West is doing to support Ukraine has not crossed that threshold. Now, we don't know where that is. And that's the issue of deterrence. That's why deterrence isn't easy and why you have to be learned. And you can't just dismiss it as not working when conflict still rages, because you have to assume where the threshold is and assume that above the threshold, deterrence is working.
Yeah, I'd also say nuclear weapons, is when you use the term nuclear weapons, they're not the Swiss Army knife of warfare. You know, they don't do everything, and they, you know, they're appropriately employed in the appropriate time. For example, you know, you say you know, a terrorist group. If there's a terrorist group that attacks the United States, you know, and there's 12 people there, a nuclear weapon is probably not the tool to use to deter them. It would, you know, my neighbor oversprays his garden and kills my flowers. A nuclear weapon would stop him from doing that. But there may be other effects and other problems I'd have in my neighborhood.
That's
such
a pretty low threshold, Jim. That threshold's too low.
But that's my point. It's just, it's not a stop for all conflict. It has a specific purpose that is part of the deterrence equation that we have got to get beyond when we talk about nuclear weapons. Right. There's so many other tools in the chest that should and could and will be used. That's why we don't have a lot of data on nuclear weapons being used for every conflict that crosses the border of, you know, killing a person or many people, as horrible. And, you know, I don't want to say that these aren't horrible things, as horrible as the events are, as what happened October 7th and in Israel. And that's the point that I make, is that you've got to look at it in terms of what are the after effects and what is the appropriate tool.
You know, the point, though, that I think that he makes that is valid and useful is that we should better understand when nuclear deterrence holds, at what levels. You know, he says, well, is it that deterrence held, or is it just that there wasn't an interest to do a certain thing? Which both could be true. But the challenge for us to make deterrence work more effectively is to understand those things better, so that we can message, so that we can posture forces, so that we can make desired threats. We can do whatever we need to do to make sure that deterrence, as we desire it to work, actually works, and that it doesn't fail.
Well, this is sort of the challenge here, is that there's this constant argument that, well, did we deter them or did they just decide not to? And the reality is, it's yes, our deterrence made them decide not to. They're not separate. They are not mutually exclusive. They are inclusive. And the things that you do, the behavior, the posture, the resourcing, the possession of weapons, impact, right, the decision to do or not do something. And it's a simple, you know, cost benefit analysis. And if you want deterrence to work, you have to credibly threaten at a point that is intolerable so that the answer is always yet, not today. And that's always the goal, to create that. It doesn't just happen. You have to convince them that it is not worth doing that. The juice isn't worth the squeeze, so to speak. And that is the essence of deterrence. And so to think that they are exclusive is a wrong way to look at the world. And that's the butterfly effect, Jim. That is the butterfly effect, is that you are doing things to change those decisions. The decisions just aren't happening.
Jim?
Well, I don't know if we're near the end, but I'll say from the standpoint of... That's where I thought you were coming in, Adam. And so, you know, from standpoint of self-aggrandizement, nice big word, for NIDS,
you spell that?
It's, yeah, it starts with an A, I believe, and a couple G's in there somewhere. But but this is why NIDS exists, to study, to evaluate, to understand how deterrence keeps us at peace. And the value that it provides for nations on both sides. I mean, you know, let's face it, if we don't go to war with somebody, it's in their benefit as well as ours. So I think the humanity is better off when we look at deterrence and understand it better. But I do worry whenever we get into these issues of the negative, trying to define a negative outcome without looking under the mat and seeing all the pieces, as Curtis said, with his butterfly effect, that what pieces go into that. And, you know, I tongue in cheek said, we need to get rid of, you know, bullets, and we need to get rid of diplomacy, we need to get treaties. No, those things all play a role, with the understanding that somewhere, that all these things are designed to deter the conflicts that lead to death and destruction, and keep us from peace and prosperity, which is where I want to be. So,
yeah.
Well, I would add to that, it's really designed to keep peace and prosperity above whatever threshold you set, right? So there's always going to be conflict below the threshold, and you must accept that. And I want to add one last thing before I sign off. These are my final thoughts here.
Are you going to use the word aggrandizement, though?
No, I'm not, because I can't pronounce it. I would say that Dr. Post notes in his piece here about a reference here to the moral pale, right? This nuclear taboo that's referred to by Nina Tannenwald, that it would be beyond the moral pale for anyone to use it. And this is sort of one of the beliefs of those who think that deterrence is easy, that everybody in the world values nuclear weapons, or should say the fear of nuclear weapons, the same, the usability of nuclear weapons, the same, the unusability, if you will, of nuclear weapons, the same. And the simple case is not, right? Our morals may be different than our adversaries' morals, and we cannot deter adversaries at the level of our morality. We must deter adversaries at the level of their morality. They are going to set that. They determine what deters them, and we have to be able to get in the mud, if that's what it means, in order to keep the peace. You must deter them at the level that they understand, that they respect, that they fear, not the artificial one that we impose upon them. Deterrence will always fail if you do that. And then Professor Post will be right all the time, but it will be because of a misapplication of deterrence and deterrence theory, not because it actually failed.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, but I did want to say that I appreciate Jim's comments. I agree with him. Physics and engineering are great, but all the hard work is done by social scientists. So thanks for making that point, Jim. That's it's something I've been trying to convince my physicist friends for a long time. So thanks. You engineers are okay people too, though. So, but unfortunately, we are out of time. And yes, the mic is off, Jim. No chance to respond. But thanks to you, the listeners, of course, for joining us on this episode of the NIDS View. And I want to remind you, check out our articles at Global Security Review. You know, you can check out all of our podcasts at thinkdeterrence.com. You can also check us out on Twitter and Getter and, you know, wherever else we might be. You can interact with us. Curtis posts interesting articles on the Think Deterrence Twitter feed every day. So we're out there. Interact. Send us an email. We look forward to hearing from you. And, of course, thanks for listening. And, you know, finally, as we always say, we want you to remember to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.